Welcome to the West Highland Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kenistan and this is episode 31. It's now Wednesday, 30th of January 2013, and our West Highland Way Race training weekend was a few days ago. I reckon there was about 30 or so that stayed for the Friday and Saturday, and then another 20 or so joined us for the run on Saturday. The plan was to run from Balmerhaugh to Invesnaid and back, which is around about 30 miles, but a few folks turned round at Rawadennan. Some went a little bit further to make it 10 miles out and 10 miles back, and then one or two actually started at Rawadennan getting a lift, and then ran to Invesnaid and then back to Balmerhaugh. So a variety of ways that people did it. And it was really good because you got to see everybody, even if it was only to say hello as they were heading back, as you were still going out or the other way around. So I thought everyone had a good time. It was great on the Saturday night, just chatting to people as well. And I think this is what a lot of these train runs are about, meeting new people and getting a chance to learn from others as well. So hopefully everyone who came had a good time and enjoyed it. The weather was certainly very kind to us. There was quite a bit of snow on the ground, but the weather was great. It was sunny most of the day and a really pleasurable time to run. If you want to see some photographs, then go to our Facebook page. And also I did a short video of about 8 minutes or so of little clips of the run. So have a look at that as well. It's either on my blog or it's on the website or it's on the Facebook. Hopefully you'll find it somewhere. So onto this podcast. On this episode, we've just got one item, and that is Ian Wallace interviewing Matt Moraz. Ian interviewed Matt for a podcast last year, and I thought it'd be interesting just to sort of get an update on what they're up to. And so after the training weekend, when they didn't just do the Saturday run, but they ran from Mulgai to Balmerhaugh on the Friday and then back again on the Sunday, making 70 miles in total, even though, as you'll hear, Matt didn't quite manage the full run on Saturday with a sore knee. But anyway, they very kindly did another interview, another update. So it's good just to catch up with what they're up to, particularly with Matt, some of the races he's doing this year and how that fits in with his plans for the West Highland Way, and some good ideas there as they go along. So hope you enjoy that, and that will come up in a moment.
So, hi, this is Ian Wallace for the West Highland Way Race podcast with Matt Moraz.
Hello.
So, hey, it's good to catch up with you again, Matt, because I think it was October last year we last spoke, and we've just been at the training weekend down in Balmerhaugh, West Highland Way Race family, so it seemed like a good opportunity to catch up again, see how things are.
Excellent, yeah, for sure.
And we thought maybe be interesting to talk a bit about your race schedule for 2013, and to think specifically about how the West Highland Way fits into that, and how your training for lots of different races, how that's going to impact on the West Highland Way.
Okay, great. So, as usual, I've got another big race calendar, big race list lined up for 2013. West Highland Way will fit in the middle of that somewhere. We'll come nicely in the centre of the year, so I'll have other races leading up to it to prepare and to use as training. And we'll see how the others go, but you know, everything before that will be a benefit to the big one in come June.
Okay, so we're now in late January.
Yep.
So what's your kind of first big race of the year?
Atacama in March is my first big one, and it's a race that's been on my calendar for maybe over a year. I was supposed to do it last year, but for one reason or another I didn't do it, so it's been on my radar for a long time, and it's something I've penciled in to go and have a real good crack at.
Okay. So this is the Atacama Crossing.
Atacama Crossing.
I'm guessing maybe some people haven't heard of the race. Do you want to just say a little bit about the background to it and how you first heard about it?
Yeah, the Atacama Crossing is one of Racing the Planet's four desert races. So I've already done the Sahara Race, the Gobi March. This is the third one in the series. I really enjoyed the other two experiences, so Atacama is always going to come next. Yeah, and I've never been to South America before, so I can't wait for that.
So it's out in Chile?
In Chile, yeah.
Driest place on earth?
I think it's the driest. So the four deserts, I can never remember which way round they are, but it's the windiest, the coldest, the driest, and the hottest.
Yeah.
I think you're right, it's the driest. So yeah, although I think last year I had a friend that did it, and on the second stage it absolutely poured down, so you never know what to expect. It's so random, so
yeah.
You expect it to be dry. I'm not going to be packing any wet weather gear anyway.
So this is a multi-stage race.
Yep.
Can you break it down just a little bit in terms of how many days, what sort of distances you'll be covering?
Yeah, of course. So the format is very similar to the Marathon des Sables race, which listeners have probably heard of more than they have the Atacama Crossing. So it's roughly speaking about a marathon a day for the first 4 days, then a double marathon, and then there'll be a rest day for anyone who's finished that double marathon in the first day. The slower runners will still be finishing on day six, and then day seven will just be something fairly short, almost like a victory lap, and it'll finish off there, yeah. So the crux of it is four marathons and then a double marathon.
Okay. And what sort of terrain are you running on there? We know it's a desert, but is there a lot of ups and downs in that?
Yeah, I think so. From what I can tell in Atacama, it's quite variable, and the hardest things that we're going to be facing are the salt flats, because they're so, it's so random. You never know what you can expect. You land each step, and are you going to crack through the salt flats, or are you going to stay on top? So that's, and the salt flats can be really sharp, and you know, can penetrate your shoes, and it's really quite gnarly. So that's going to be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
But as for dunes, like Sahara, you'd expect the Sahara Desert to be the biggest dunes. There are some, but nothing compared to Gobi. Gobi was enormous with the sand dunes, which was great fun. I think there's quite a lot of sand this time as well, but I think it's mainly the salt flats that we've got to be aware of.
So it's that kind of rocky terrain, almost like a kind of lunar landscape type thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And almost like running on ice. You don't know how your footing's going to be. You don't know how strong these salt flats are. You don't know if you're going to sink a foot or you're going to stand on top of it. So it's so hard to get any rhythm because you've got to brace yourself to keep cracking through this stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so for me, who's only ever run a kind of single day ultra, and I'm sure there'll be many other listeners as well, I'm kind of interested in how your training for these multi-stage events differs and, or, you know, what similarities are, what the differences are?
Well, I guess the main thing with the training is, like we've had this weekend, back-to-back runs. Mm. There's no way you can face a 6 or 7 day race without definitely getting into that back-to-back running, so that you're teaching your legs that just because you ran one day doesn't mean to say they're not going to get pounded again the following day.
Mm.
And the more you run those back-to-back stuffs, the quicker your recovery seems to become. So yeah, that's the essential part.
Okay.
Then you've got to obviously think about things like in the Marathon des Sables, you carry all your own gear. So for instance, in the Sahara race, my first one, I took so much food that I started the race probably with 11 or 12 kilograms on my back, which is far too much. I got that as low as 6 kilograms when I started Gobi. This is without the water. But even 6 kilograms makes a hell of a difference, so you really have to prepare for that. Yeah, it really slows you down. So.
What's your target weight for carrying for Atacama?
Well, something like 6 kilograms, or if I could just squeeze just under, then fantastic, yeah. Every pound, every few grams, you have to get so obsessive with trying to get the weight down in the pack.
Mm.
Sometimes you have to pay over the odds for a jacket or a spork made of titanium just to save like the odd few grams. But if you look at every single piece of equipment on the mandatory kit list with that idea, then it's amazing the amount of savings you can make.
Yeah, sure.
The biggest issue though is with the food, because you know that's where all your weight is. And do you take 2,000 calories a day, which is the bare minimum you're allowed to take? You have to take at least a mandatory 2,000 calories a day. Mm-hmm. Or do you take more and you're carrying more, but you get more nutrition into you? So it's getting the balance right of how much do I need each day to feel good and not feel completely wiped out and hungry, mm-hmm. but also carrying the bare minimum. So that's where the equation, you know, I don't think anyone really knows exactly, but you just have to go with how you feel it's going to work for you.
And in the past, when you've done these desert races, have you had real food as well as like powders and gels and so on?
The first time I had a lot of these freeze-dried meals.
Yeah.
But a lot of them you get sick of very, very quickly. It's tough. You know what it's like in a big ultra yourself. I mean, towards the end of the West Highland Way or something, you don't know what you're going to fancy eating. And your appetite will go. And I think you can multiply that by five when you're in the desert. The last thing you want is some creamy, sickly, freeze-dried meal of, you know, porridge with strawberries in the morning. And it might be good on day one, and before you go, you think, oh, this is going to get me through. But by the second time you've eaten it, or you might eat half of that second time, then you just want to throw the rest of them away because you're already sick of it. So when I did Gobi after that, my first experience, I took noodles. So many noodles, because
okay.
I can always eat noodles.
Yeah,
it's easy, and you eat them with like as a noodle soup, so you've got the fluids as well.
Yeah.
So they always go down really well.
I suppose that's quite a good lesson for races like the West Highland Way as well. As like, if there's one food that you can always go to and you can always eat, you know, for some people it might be something that's a bit more liquid in consistency, you know, like rice pudding, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
everyone's different, obviously, but just knowing that you're however bad you're feeling, you're probably going to be able to eat it.
Yeah, I think some people are great at this and they convince themselves that the food is just my fuel and it doesn't matter how horrible it is, I just have to get it in me. But I can't do that. I need something that is palatable to me at that time, because if not, it'll turn my stomach even the thought of it.
Sure.
So yeah, you've got to identify what's going to work for you every single time without fail.
Yeah.
Like I say, I think we've discussed this before, but more fluidy kind of meals, I think, however bad you're feeling, it takes 5 seconds to knock back 300 milliliters of liquid that could be mixed up with something. So yeah, rather than having to chew through something, maybe when you're dehydrated and you might not even have the saliva to sort of chew and break these things down, but a drink.
And you said as well that water is provided, and presumably that's rationed per competitor.
Yeah, it's fairly generous. Every checkpoint is about 10 kilometres. You have to take a minimum of 1.5 litres of water at every checkpoint. And every time you finish each day, you get an allocation of 4.5 litres to get you through to the next morning. And that's enough. I've found that's enough in the past. I think if it's particularly hot, if it's in the 50 degrees,